The Emma Press is a new independent publisher from Reading, which is dedicated to publishing books which are sweet, funny, and easy on the eye. They published a book called the Emma Press Anthology of Mildly Erotic Verse last year, partly in response to the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon, and tonight we're going to find out more about what mildly erotic verse is. Publisher Emma Wright is going to explain some of the inspiration behind the book, and we're going to hear readings from four of the poets involved with the book. Richard O'Brien, who won the Foyle Young Poet of the Year Award in 2006 and 2007, and whose pamphlet of love poems, The Emoras, was published by the Emma Press earlier this year. He's currently studying for a master's at the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-on-Avon, and has a third pamphlet coming out this year with Dead Ink. We also have Jacqueline Safra, who a former winner of the first prize in the Ledbury Poetry Competition, no less. Her first full collection, The Kitchen of Lovely Contraptions, is out with Flipped Eye, and she has an illustrated pamphlet of prose poems coming out with the Emma Press in November. Then we have Rachel Piercy, who co-edited the Emma Press anthology of Mildly Erotic Verse. She is also an editor on the Cadaverine magazine, and she won the Newdigate Prize in 2008. When I read that, I thought it was the Newgate Prize, and she was making it rude by adding the nudie bit at the front, but I was so wrong. It is the Newdigate Prize. And finally, we have Gerald Yam, who is the youngest Singaporean to be nominated for the Pushcart Prize. He has two full collections of poetry out, with Math Paper Press, and his third, Intruder, is due out later this year. He's just finished studying law at UCL. So, let's relax and enjoy this mildly erotic poetry from the Emma Press, which I'm sure is done in the best possible taste. Over to Emma.
Thank you, Leslie. Yes, I'm Emma Wright. I run the Emma Press, and it's incredibly thrilling to be reading at the Ledbury Poetry Festival this year. So well done for coming. Thank you for coming tonight, and also well done for being brave and venturing into the unknown of mildly erotic verse. I want to reassure you that there's nothing too extreme in the show, but some of it may be quite intense. You're going to experience some pretty hot verse, some mind-blowing metaphors, and a few poetic meters that you may not have heard of before. So just to explain a little bit about the background to the book, I was working for a large publisher around the time that 50 Shades of Grey was published, and suddenly we had to produce a lot of erotic fiction. So I was producing the ebooks, and I read quite a few of them just because they were coming my way and I was interested. And it really struck me that even though there were the novelists were writing about sex in quite a lot of detail, they were kind of somehow evading the actual eroticism of sex just by being so detailed and writing about the kind of mechanics and the sounds rather than the headspace, which I think is really the more erotic part of sexuality. So in creating the mildly erotic anthology, I really encourage poets to think more about the messier side of things, which as humans we can't help but experience. So there's always the history, there's the hang-ups, there's the just, you know, the lack of glamour in everyday life, which I think is part of a really big part of eroticism. So in the first half of the show, the poets are going to read poems which kind of peel back the glamour of kind of sex as presented in the media, perhaps, and maybe in our imaginations, and reveal something of the truth behind sex. And then we'll move into a slightly more intense phase. And so that's the most intense part of the show. And then I'll come back and introduce the second half, and we'll take a slightly more positive turn. So now you know what you're in for. Hopefully you're still excited. So now I'm going to hand over. So the poets are all going to read a few poems from the book, as well as so their own poems, as well as a few by other people. They'll introduce themselves. And everyone's going to be reading quite short sets, so I wanted to create a bit of movement on stage and just suggest the fluidity of sexuality. Not really. So if I could ask you not to clap after each poem, is that will kind of interrupt the flow, but to clap right at the end.
A lot.
Yes, a lot. Okay, so now we're going to hear from Richard O'Brien.
This is called Magician's Assistant. I wrote it in a sauna in Finland. And when I say wrote it, I thought of it, and then I wrote it when I was not in the sauna because it was literally too steamy. Magician's Assistant. Legs. Released by the entrance song, they spread like an accordion. Collapse. I have been working on resistance to your charms, and failing that, my upper arms. Dry ice evades all smoke alarms. After the show, I hold your cloak above the dust of the retail park. Step lightly, darling, through the dark. Your sequined foot unsticks the clutch. Unchoreographed, our belts click shut. An escapologist is never stuck. One room. You clatter through the minibar. Your wrists, their first-time fire-thrower scars. My heart's a sleeve that won't stop spilling scarves. I'm breathless at your sleight of hand. Be good to me, the great, the grand. The cushions levitate. I never see them land. We climb inside your velvet trunk, dodge hidden drawers, jujures and junk, half-dressed and more than halfway drunk, and bring the lid down, plush with galaxies that stroke your spine, lending their light to me. I'm finding glitter in your hair for weeks. Another town. You spin the box, then come toward me, blade aloft, brushing my fingers when you turn the locks. I curl my knees up, count to 10, and let you split me, put me back again. Exhale. I was a different person then.
So I met this couple who told me about their first date, and this is my take on it, which I'm not sure they would recognise, but what they said to me sort of sent me off in a flight of imagination. It's called The Kitchen of Lovely Contraptions. There was once a man who claimed he'd been assaulted by a woman's underwear. Invited back for coffee, he'd walked into the kitchen where ranks of brassieres and panties hung from a ceiling trap in readiness for ambush. Stockings brushed his cheeks, hooks and buttons snagged on his hair, straps and ribbons tied him to a place he longed for always without knowing. As a fine layer of lace wrapped itself around his eyes, he was breathless, helpless at the pink, coal face of femininity, and fell into a beautiful swoon. When he woke, he was captive. His life became a sweet, slow undoing and redoing of those fastenings. And, or so the story goes, the coffee never came. So this is a poem by John Stone, and watch out for the wonderfully sly rhyme scheme and the surprising journey of this poem, which really shows a sexual relationship, I suppose, ultimately in its nakedness and messiness, all in the best possible taste. Glamour. Beneath the boiled wool, he's just a skelly bones. And underneath the skelly bones, a fumbling boy. And underneath the boy, he's one of Jakey's twins. And under that, he's nothing but a bumblebee. Peel back the bee, and he's a coddled emperor. And under that, she stumbles on a beery goon. But under that, none other than Hercule Poirot. And under Poirot, he's just a boy again. And she's a sweet thing, underneath the stars and spurs, a cloud beneath the sweet thing, and then under that he finds a girl who sports a look of faint surprise, but she too falls away and leaves a cinder smut. The cinder smuts a cover. She's a grizzly bear and then a toy maker and then a tomahawk and finally a girl who's been to Zanzibar, a girl who thinks she might be an insomniac. They know the thing to do tonight is sleekly slide against each other's planes the way they do in films, be spoon and syrup, glass and shadow, blade and blade. But now the smell of overripeness overwhelms the both of them, and out they slip from underneath the glamours that had all but pinned them in their place. Two grubbied up potato dolls with sticky breath, and all the more delighted for their ugliness.
My first poem is by Emma Ray. Have you imagined having sex with me? Planned exactly how it would be? Have you pictured all the faces? The sighs, the eyes, the grimaces. Have you schemed how we'd get started? Am I flash naked, legs parted? Or maybe there's some backstory of brave knights and morning glory, or a plumber, or a pizza boy. And what am I, coquette or coy? Am I Russian or am I Thai? With skin on thin or fat on thigh? Am I a pliable, edible fool? Or cougar clawed, matured and cruel? Do I like you? Do you hope I do? Do you wish I were more open with you? I might be flora, or fauna, or eve, or dawn, alder trees, laurel leaves, spider, swan. I am 5'7", fair, Caucasian, territory vulnerable to invasion. I am all states. I am armies campaigning. I am trying and taxing and waxing and waning. I'm in orbit. I'm a film on repeat. I'm victory. I'm cold. I'm young. I'm defeat. I stretch for miles, and if you tried to run like a stream down a mountainside, more faithful than you meant to be, you could run for hours and never leave me. My second poem is about coming to terms with other people's erotic experiences. Look to your daughters, careful parents, for they are numerous in nature, blue-eyed boys with new hearts that need tending. These boys are keen to love, and your daughters will spend long hours bending over them. Your daughters' hair will fall on their unworthy faces. Your daughters' ecstatic lips will make them grow. Your daughters will water them, and your daughters will come in from the garden, wild-eyed, and you will have to let your daughters go again, back to the boys, though you know how your daughters will be cut on the opening rows of them.
So my first poem is written on an airplane. It may or may not have been inspired by real-life events, but ambiguity is always sexy. So, Alias. Next to me, the airline blanket unfolded like a mother's shrewd embrace, licking the places where our shoulders start and start again. Your eyes are streaming against opalescent currents, up over their flustered lids, pans gearing for a boil. I wonder what the vision is, what sanctuary glimpsed as my palm grazes the electric limits of your manhood, feeding friction to its ochre jaw, each parallel motion like the oarsman's race to another unsympathetic shore. Throwing a gaze to the sleeping passengers as if guilt happens before pleasure, then whispering the whisper I have earned, like a secret unclasped. I'm almost there, almost there. My hand tugs madly, competitive. Your semen raw on my skin like the milk of a cracked fruit, like punishment. No more questions when running it down the sink, my face in the mirror like visions suited and multiplied, no more but all of myself, fear, longing, repentance, and the plane bending hard to kiss the back of the world. Second poem is written by Mel Denham, also part of the Mowley Erotic Anthology. To September from June. I am already mythologizing. Maybe that's why I invoke a Greek hero's quest as we descend the steep stairs to a Smith Street streaked with late night rain. In your version of heaven, you live in a caravan by the sea. In mine, there's a city apartment, a decorous distance from your untrustworthy hands. We would meet, but not too often, having had plenty of practice caressing the palpable texture of absence. In my dim-lit room, cluttered with books, I would taste salt on your lips. On your sheets, we'd disheveled with an earshot of the moan and sigh of waves. You'd bury your face in my hair's faint car exhaust scent. Don't let me get too old, you say, as if I can stop time like you. Kill speech when you put your mouth to mine. Oh, loosen the tongues of my mute body. In place of that paradise on which the sun may never rise, know this instead. Tonight, when your familiar voice speaks and your familiar hand moves, it's a present pleasure I can't grasp to keep my own hand table-bound and calm, the clamor from my take me, traitorous heart.
Truth or dare? These boys are always called Billy or Finn, the ones who lead you into the woods at just that age and dare you to eat mushrooms. I'll swallow whatever you do, lava discs bursting from mountains of tree, white fists rising out of the dirt, if you go first. Close your eyes and hope he gets it, your double pledge of trust and true love that licks its lips at death. Bonfire is, I guess, inspired by the pain that can sometimes go hand in hand with desire. Bonfire. I have felled all the trees in my wood to keep you going, thrown old faithfuls and flimsy startled saplings into your hot ears and come to bed mouth. Then all that was left was the pointy scent of gum and the bellow of an oak. So I hacked off my hair with barely a second thought, and both ears were carelessly slung in, then my thumbs with their crucial opposability. I've got my toes lined up and my unaccountable hips, and my knees are ready too, so please give me more of your particular brand of alchemy. Because when you temper scraps into treasure, I think it's worth it. And when you spit out glass, though you only got sand, I think it's worth it. Because I could spot you a mile away on any frightening night, and when I got there, you'd soften me. Because I hope that when I'm down to just my heart in the open air, you'll keep it warm.
And the next two poems that I will read were written in my first year at law school at UCL. So it's basically about the transience of, well, undergrad relationships, as cliched as that might sound. Compass. These are maps I would interrogate on late Friday nights, someone else's weakness eddying in the quiet valley of my navel before hardening to stains. Sometimes we trace tongues over them, as if charting an impossible future between us, coating each other's lips with warm varnish, the hard-earned brine of the male body. We know we are doing this for ourselves. Guilt assumes the perfect excuse for greed, both endlessly balancing pleasure in different directions. I tell the next one not to expect anything else, especially that I will love him, but cannot help the disappointment of each succeeding obedience. Then we do it again. Then your chest is drawn over mine like a mountain's shadow, so convinced that intimacy has room for habit. While I remember the taste cloying to my tongue, is not a journey I can indulge in forever. The next poem is entitled Ego. I am poring over my phone again, tugging at its leash of names, so persistent the need to be understood beyond my room's disparaging walls. Sorry. Who is not expecting love and yet has time for another? In the window, only lights from neighboring apartments stubbing out the last of their unappreciated fires. Even at this hour, loneliness invites strangers to knock on the stubborn door of my pelvis, each thrust a comforting violence, pushing me back into the space ordained for me to fill. There is nothing else. No matter how generous the night, how stars fasten themselves to the sky as sequins, I will not succeed in finding rest. All I want is that constant digging into the virile soil of my canal, uncovering fresh earth, only to leave empty-handed, but sated, which is half better than what anyone could have started with.
Feeling quite hot? Bondage. I once knew a woman who was Houdini's opposite. No hands, unaided, she had taught herself to gag her wants with masking tape, shackle her feet, bind her own wrists in the manner of famous sadists. She was a smouldering starlet, a five-pointed miracle artfully arranged on the crispness of linen. She'd brand the mattress with her hourglass of flesh while she waited for her man to save her, and sure enough, he'd always turn up just in time, ready to rip the tape from her lips, slit the knots, turn the key, and set her free to perform her act over and over, each time with more of that slick, irresistible conviction. What pleasure was there? She called it love. He called it getting a grip. So I guess love and sex are, you know, volleying for position in a lot of my poems. And this one's, I guess, about the man who got away. Mile End. Not like the sight of the inedible fish that lay curled on the plate with its garnish of bright parsley in that bistro in Curzon Street in 1981 when you leaned forward to tell me. More like when we dropped acid and the branches were parsley too and the fish heads sang Don't You Want Me through wet mouths and your face was a sun and then a moon with my head bent back in the manner of a Chagall. Not like when I bought oyster mushrooms in Petticoat Lane as an alibi for my mother, and you told me you'd slept with Jane and Louise in some room for hire in Soho. Not like those times you got inside me, once in the attic at Jocelyn's party, one time at least after you married Martha, who always said everything was phenomenal, once after Grace was born. More like that other time that reminded me of snow. But not like that bistro when, now I come to think of it, you didn't lean towards me but away. More like that dull Sunday in your hard-to-let flat in Mile End while Martha was in the other room feeding the baby and you murmured, sorry, sorry, sorry. One hand on my cheek, one hand on my hand.
This is a poem about overcoming sexual nerves by pretending you're Bob Dylan. Songs about Louise. It's something near to nakedness to hear each other sing. You know now how my weak vibrato tenor trembles like a virgin, and your pure tones address that slips from shoulders far too sleek to see your fingers trilling down the zip. Baez and Dylan found a way of harmonizing, side by side in rolling thunder. You and me, babe, keep in key. But if we start to slide asunder, I can set your teeth on edge, the rising hum from sharp to flat through every nerve from neck to knee, the jangle in the beating blood that's tangled up in you and blending red with blue, ascending from your chest to head and fending off serrated notes that catch it by its messy hair and scratch the air above the bed that's empty to the open throat a breath away from pure whistle. Cactus flower, fruiting thistle, wild and thin as mercury, and every freckle spiking grace from G to F to middle C and into bass. Your face is spreading like a semi-breve. It's over now, Queen Jane, Johanna, Sarah, Lily, Rosemary, sad-eyed lady, lonesome sparrow, absolutely, Sweet Marie. And I hadn't realized, but it seems Jackie and I both have poems which use the pictorial styles of specific painters as sexual metaphors. So spot these if you're playing at home. This is Desire Path. So here, my friend, is the lie of the land. Tonight, I want to make you arch your neck like a figure in a Francis Bacon painting. But it's hard to argue with cartography. Half the country is against us, as things stand. Which presupposes that things have to stand. That conference centres matter more than this. That outlet villages have reasons to exist. Tonight, the landscape is a blot upon itself. Its contours are a sad excuse for yours. And if I could, I'd call tornadoes down to wrench up roofs of Collie Western slate, disintegrate unyielding dry stone walls and crazy pave a path across the fields to your door, demolish every stile but yours. Make every gate a kissing gate and make a list of everything you've never done so we can do it, then declare each place we do a national park. Or we could build an island of our own, invite rare seabirds, raise a screen of reeds, and there direct each other in the dark, describe a line from hip to rib to jaw, complete the jigsaw of our collarbones. But not tonight. Tonight we need the tarmac to metastasize, an oil slick on which I'd slide towards you on my tarred and feathered knees through every other sight of natural beauty.
Thank you, Richard. Well, I hope you're all right and not too overcome. So the second half is more of a celebration of sex. So the first half was an exploration of the difficulties and the intensity. I wanted to leave you on more of a high note. So the first section will be more about intense romance and how, well, just how kind of intense loveliness and kindness and caring can also be exciting and erotic, which I feel is something that kind of got left behind a bit in the whole 50 Shades of Grey thing. Most of the poets will be reading their poems from the book, so you'll get an insight into their personal understanding of eroticism, which is, I think, was almost very interesting, and not something you can really just ask anyone. So it's very handy to have them in poem form. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm going to pass over now to Rachel, who will tell you about some of her personal tastes.
Yes, I'd like to share something with you, an interest of mine, which will be evident from the title. In Praise of Bicycle Helmets. God, I love men who care for their heads, who want no bed of slabs and fag ends, no small cliff of curb for a pillow. As they pedal by,
skulls sheathed in expanded polystyrene. I go weak. How clearly it speaks of character. These men have the correct priorities. They respect the worst fears of their mothers. Here's no flippancy to follow. I love you for your exoskeleton, your branded, moulded, outside brain. Stranger, will you let me ride Pillion? You're going where I want to go. I trust all three of us with pain. And then this one is in celebration of erotic excess, particularly the sort that you tend to feel with a new partner. And there's a little blank space in the poem to insert the name of your current object of desire. And as it's a version of Catullus 5, I'll use the name of Catullus's flighty mistress, Lesbia. When I grew up, I got Catullus. Let us live, my Lesbia, and let us love, and ignore the bores who prose about us growing up and out of lust. The sun will always roll around the globe, but the hours we can rest to roll together round the bed are numbered. So, give me 1,000 kisses, then another 100, and another 1,000, and another 100, and talk about us till our friends stop asking, and leave your job and move where mine is. I've got you a diamond and a puppy, and we'll name our children while we walk it, and we'll list the countries we want to visit, and book for next year and the one after, and insist we're both invited to parties, and disgust all the guests with our plus one ardour. Oh, kiss me all the way to the tattoo parlour. And print us with proof, a pair of sparrows bearing our initials. With our arms together, they fly in the same air, and no one can erase the song they share.
So before I get typecast as a depressing poet, here are just a couple of more light-hearted ones, so feel free to laugh or snort or swear at me, I guess. Botany. When a boy doesn't shave, it is hard to locate a trunk in the hirsute jungle. No one is in the mood for guessing. The only remedy is to rouse it from slumber. Tongue as shovel, reliable. Unshackle it from vines. Who says gardening is not a job for real men? And the second one is entitled Crop. I saw the easing, heaving, before breaking the surface like swimmers, hairs on my hand, on each intolerant finger, driven by their own arterial clocks. It was too long since they discovered your lips, your irreverent tongue riding between the valleys of my fingers without destination. Today, the air would not agree. It refused to dwell in twin sanctums of my palms, my hairs like a garden you raped for months, faithful as sunrise, then left for good.
This is a poem by a poet called Andrew Wynne-Owen, who had a pamphlet, Raspberries for the Ferry, published by the Emma Press earlier this year. Your smile. It arrests me today. Happiness spun in skin. Landscape sculpted from life's lightest discursiveness. And a scene that I, breath batedly, wait to scan. I'm a fool for your tongue, neck for your laughter's noose, and I'd sing, if I could, tributes in ancient Norse. Love, I think you're the grain ground in my labour's mill. I could wither and wilt, waiting for you to smile. It's a law of my eye always to seek out charm, and I'd follow your smile far as my feet can run. I could live on your lips, calling their corners home, and enshrine all the words slowly in rhyme and rune, that you spill like the split, seconding sound of rain. It's a marvel to me, world has a you within, where the ripples you make meet me at every turn. When that time is at hand, time to relinquish life, I'll remember your smile breaking and burning on, and I'll twirl into death carelessly like a leaf that has spread in the fresh force of the Tuscan sun. Yes, you're all of the thrill, none of the fall of sin, and the heat that I feel, looking you eye to lip, is the proof of two selves starting to overlap.
I think this is a poem about love, about sex, but also about letting go. The frozen man. At the cusp of the year, in absolute dark, she calls his name. She catches scatters of him in the soft cup of her hands until he is too much to hold. He falls and falls until he covers the bed. Slowly she breathes him into warmth, her pink tongue patient against his white-blue beauty, her body moulding him, her legs embracing him. She knows his coldness will not keep. Before the spring, he will melt complete from her hands. And this is a poem for anyone who might think that either love or sex are behind them. And it's called it's called Charm for Late Love. Would you like a glass of water? Okay. Charm for Late Love. Here we go again, my old crow. I'll ride your bone back, edge and turn, up where the wind songs coil and glow, feathers fall and currents churn. Candle, gutter, flare and burn. Let the stars drip sodden light. We'll find the shine once more. We'll name our quarry, rattle it through night. Let's taste the blood of the ancient game. Candle, snuff, gutter and flame. Let's wing it, old crow. Deny the laws of chance, how hard it is to catch and hold a joy in yellowed claws, to risk the slip, outface the crash. Candle, gutter, snuff and ash. Let your straightened wings unfold, eclipse the moon with a surge and sweep through grip and glint of marrow cold. Let's hunt the heart we'll never keep. Candle, gutter, snuff and sleep.
This poem has an epigraph, which is from a book of medieval travel writing, which is as reliable as you would imagine. It's called The Book of Sir John Mandeville. And beyond these isles, there is another isle that is clept Paitan. The folk of that country ne till not, ne labour not the earth, for they eat no manner thing. These men live by the smell of wild apples, and when they go any far way, they bear the apples with them, for if they had lost the savour of the apples, they should die anon. And if you don't find Middle English literature sexy, the poem is slightly more erotic. The smell of apples. Oh, give me the thread from the hem of your dress that you caught in St. James's Park, and give me the blank and the blink of your eyes before they adjust to the dark, and give me the space in the skin of your throat that you smooth away with a breath, and the infinitesimal decimal point between your tongue and your teeth. Then give me the drip of a droplet of water that found its way down through your hair. And give me the light that your body divided and spread like a sodium flare. Now give me the dust that you brushed from your jeans on the chairs in the station cafe. And give me the spark that was spat from the track of the train that took you away. And give me the dot on the eye on the map of the village where you live. Cross of the T in a neighbouring town, if it's all you've got to give. And then give me a signal, a cipher, a sign, a trinket, a token, a ring, and I'll follow it blind to the base of your spine, and I'll give you everything.
Sometimes eroticism can be very beautifully balanced, however unconventional. Symbiosis. The Egyptian plover takes for his lover the Nile crocodile,
an unlikely pairing, feathers with scales, finicking wade with splayed legs, but she welcomes him, wet-eyed and wide-jawed. He hops within and tenderly plucks leeches from her gums, so light on her tongue that each deft step is barely felt, as surviving shifts into caress. He knows from observation the snap of tessellating maw round prey, and once saw his love rip shreds from a giraffe. When he waded out, the river ran red. But they share four-chambered hearts, which beat in time, and he eats at the table of her smile.
The next poem is inspired by an encounter at a swimming pool, and it's also included in the anthology. Prize. Like a swig of medicine, the undressing is easy. I watch the sun rehearse over the arena, its lonely eye laying mahogany sheets on a row of strangers. Then, when it rages enough for a change, I slip soundlessly in the pool, legs pivoting for the kickoff, as if recalling the force with which a man enters my quiet chamber. And the sun agrees, setting live wires over a turquoise floor. I am drawn to its audacity, its electrical charm tamed by water. Later in the changing room, we would smile, just short of crime, desperation stiffening like a drug as we become conjoined at the pelvis, every breath also traced with time's impatient handwriting. It ends as it may only end, wrenched free to false safety as if afraid of intimacy. I press a finger to the slag, to my lips, its awkward musk stinging like genius. By then, you would have gone, so sure of diving into another life.
Thank you for listening. This is our last poem. Our last poem. It's my last poem and our last poem. And it's about the first and only time I ever rode a horse. I once rode a palomino on a hot Tunisian beach. And being an equestrian virgin at the time, I thought riding a horse was like driving a car. And when you made that clicking noise with your tongue, you were stepping on the gas. And when you said, whoa, you were putting on the brakes. But here's the thing about horses. You mount the beast, thinking you're in charge, and the next thing you know, you're off, with something wild and alive between your legs. And did I mention the massive stallion behind me, and that mine was a mare in heat, and the fast, wet gallop along the shoreline, me hanging in there, thigh muscles straining, and the kids open-mouthed with their buckets and spades, and the topless women screaming, and the men shouting commands, dismount, dismount. Two horny horses cavorting in the swell. Not exactly the riding lesson I was expecting, but that's okay, because when I remember that hot, wet, salty afternoon, I usually think of you.